2 weeks ago, we were working with the basic form for your bibliographical material. And as I said then, I want to repeat again today, I don't intend to go through all these different types. For simple reason, you forget most of it anyhow. But I would like to call your attention to some of them, so highlight them. And so you can find some of the rhyme and reason, as it were, that underlies the general rule. Last time I said that basically a bibliographical form is made up of the three parts, namely the author, the title, and the publication data. I think we took A to E, and now I think I'll use the 7 mile boots and go through quite rapidly, but please stop me if at any point there must be some clarification or some question or doubt in your mind. F, when the author is not a single person but a committee or a group, then that group is set forth as the author, as in this case, the United States Department of Commerce, Bureau of the Census. You really have two. One's a subdivision of the other, of course, and they're treated that way with periods between them. You're using both volumes, and so both volumes are mentioned. Now, a minor, just the head of the titles, when you know the author and then an editor, or an author and a translator. Sometimes you have to make an arbitrary decision when the author or the editors are hardly known, and the book itself, on its own merit, is the way it's usually recalled. The Triglot, for instance. No one would look under B, Bente, for that book. Many even know that he was one of the editors, and for that reason could actually be ignored and put it in its simplest form, Triglot Concordia. Now, actually, it really should have the names of the editors, but as I say, this is one place where you get an arbitrary decision. You probably wouldn't run more than one in a thesis. You probably wouldn't have any in most of your theses. But it would be better form, and I'm just giving it in its simplest form, a better form if you would follow this format but add the editors, as you do, for instance, in the next one, although not at that point. When there are two or three editors, you follow the same thing as you would with more than one author. When you have another, there are all kinds of combinations, and one really can't exhaust them all. Author or editor and organization. So, in other words, when the organization, the committee, the commission, authorized the man to edit it, it gets its direction, it gets its theology or its philosophy or its principles from the commission that authorized it. It's important enough, they must be included. As you have the next one, William A. Kramer, editor, general course of study for Lutheran elementary schools. It's an official job, so it's published under the auspices of a certain board. When the author is not known and cannot be identified, or not given and cannot be identified, then it goes under the title, as you see under M. But if you can identify him, it may have come out originally anonymously, but as time went on, the author is known. And as the next one, the definite platform. It came out, nobody knew, or very few people knew, I should probably say, but today everybody knows that Schmucker did it. But it's not on the title page. And so that's indicated by putting it in brackets, and these brackets are written in with indie ink. Unless you happen to have a typewriter, most of you probably will not have it, with the brackets included. That, of course, will take care of the whole thing. Do not make one, so to speak, with the slash and with a hyphen here and try to build one. Simply because it takes more time, frankly, than it's really worth. As in magazine articles, only the initial is given. Unidentified, then it has to be put in their form. This is at the end of this article, all you see is AC. And assuming that C is the family name, you then turn it around, and it's under C. If, however, you know who it is, you can identify it as for many years the witness, editors merely initial their articles. And so obviously this PWG, or WGP rather, was always Dr. Pollock. You notice you have a double space between the P and the O to give you room for your bracket. Now the rest I think we can run through very rapidly, even more so than in the past. When you use the entire series or set, such as Luther's works, Sämtliche Schriften, the 25 volumes, you simply put down 25. That's what this means, that you've consulted all of them. Now that's very rarely going to be the case, of course, unless you're a thesis built on, was built on Luther's viewpoint or something. Then, of course, you probably would have to include all, or chances are, though, you'd probably limit it to some phase of his writings. But this assumes all of it. If, however, only one or two have been used, you use the next one, the R. It's book in a series, but you've used the entire volume. Yes, sir?
When you list these names, now, you must say, if you list it in full, the middle name included?
If the name is given, yes. It should, rather. Let's say... simply because in the course of events you often have people with the same name. To avoid, you don't know ahead of time whether it's going to be one of these cases, although I suppose if you had something like Snaeschwitz or something like that, it wouldn't be very many like that. But if you have a Miller or a Meyer or a Schmidt, you can you take the odds, it'll be as good as the Dodger Oriole series, it'll be as good as that.
There's no option?
No, there really isn't. Now, in some cases, some publishers even demand, or really make a pretty strong man demand, rather, that you find out what it is, if there is one. And this way, your library card help you. Oftentimes, it's not, the whole name isn't written out. It's just John A. And then you'll notice it's often penciled in. It's for that very reason why they pencil it in, to help you in your pursuit. This is where the Library of Congress material is very helpful, because they try to find it also. But for a thesis, it is not necessary to add the middle name if you have the initial, if it isn't given. I mean, you don't have to spend time on looking out the man's name. Publishers sometimes require it. Obviously, it's over the service when you can. The same thing, however, is true. The same thing is not true when you're referring to an important person, or it doesn't have to be important, any person in your thesis, try to get the full name of the man. That will help your reader to identify, because in the course of events there are a lot of people who have the same name, and it may not even be a very common name. Or book in a series. Now you're just using number one. You were theoretically using just volume 13 to 26. No, pardon me. I'm sorry. This is volume 18. But the homilies of I guess I should start all over. It's part of the title, this particular one. I was misled. It's the homilies out of 1 Samuel, chapters 13 to 26. Well, here, you're only using volume 58 of the corpus. Now, you're using the whole book, and therefore it's underlined. And you have two underlinings, because the title of the book and the series of the book. Anything on R? This one comes up often, but I think there are enough variety of samples here to help you out. Yes, sir?
Now, in R1, why isn't the name of the editor mentioned in that case?
Well, it's one of those cases, again, where the editor is practically an unknown person, or, like the corpus, I think the corpus is one of them, where the editor has changed so often because it took so many years to get out. The same thing with the Weimar edition. This would be true, by the way, also with, no, I didn't put it down for that reason, Georg Vasova. I don't know how many editors have worked. The book has outlived a number of editors.
In a book that's been translated, and the translation has changed
titles
completely, is there room within the author to put the original title?
You may. That's an option.
Where would you put it?
In parentheses, and then you begin to do your own editing. Originally appeared as something of that nature. and then give the, that's to be helpful to your, another way, of course, is to list it both ways in your bibliography, and, well, no, that would be, I was thinking something else, because it would be the same man who wrote it. It would be the same spot. Now, it'd be better if you help the reader by giving that alternate title in parentheses. Yes, this is quite important, since the Americans don't usually, or often do not, let's put it that way, give you a translation, partly because the European may be too cumbersome or too prosaic when it gets to be translated. Everyone is, yes, each one is listed separately. Now, if it's, no, I'm afraid you'd have, because they have different titles. You'd have to list each one separately. Mm-hmm. And the same thing would be true with the next category. Articles in a book of a series, where you're not taking volume 10 of Sämtliche Schriften, but only one part of it, Ein Sermon. And that is now in quotes to indicate that it's a part. It's a sermon of 1518, and so the title goes after the number 1518. Now notice, you don't have V-O-L period X, or you could, because you have columns or pages listed. Under R3, notice it says volume 10. In S, it has merely X or 10. Simply, whenever you have the X and the pages, you don't have to put down volume, and you don't have to put down double P. But simply, X65. However, this is one slight exception here, because it doesn't have to be pages, with columns, and that's why you add the C-O-L-S. Strictly speaking, I suppose some would say that isn't even necessary, the columns, because all you have to do is open the book and you know it's numbered by columns. And so there's no mistake, you don't know the answer until you get the book, and you probably don't want the answer until you get the book. So it's somewhat redundant. Double title, you have, the only thing there is that you have a colon between the title, and look at IH, or the one H, I should say, excuse me. Where here we stand, colon, that's on top of page 3, nature and character of the Lutheran faith. Simply indicates how this particular matter is held. When no date is given, you don't leave it blank, but after the city of publication, you put down ND, no date. If you can figure it out, for some reason you know it, then again, you add it by putting the bracket and the date. Same thing with the publisher. No publisher given, NP. W gives you the oftentimes a edition is mentioned, fourth revised edition, and that is put down immediately after the title. Whether it's fourth edition or fourth revised edition or revised edition, that all depends on what the book itself says. So much for entire books. Now, when you use only a part of a book, and actually we had one like that already on the bottom of page 4, remember, articles in a book of a series, but the book was still the important thing. From a one-volume edition, well, this is the way you do the same thing as you had on the bottom of page 4. Grevener, quote, Faith and Reason. That's the title of the essay. And then the rest is underlying what Lutherans are thinking. That's the double one again, colon, a symposium, and so on. Same thing with Martin Luther. That's a repetition of the previous one. Then the pages are given because no volume is indicated. Well, there is only one volume. Same thing with Formula of Concord. The difference being that the one has no author, a single author, and the other one has. From a book in a series, it's the same deal. Now here you know there you may appear to be a contradiction, because the pages are indicated. Here you have an option.
You have no option when you have it like this. But as you read the thing, you could have volume 10 and then some more data and some more data, and then because that's so far removed, you could put down pages 65, but it's an option. You could omit it here, but of course if you omit it here, you have to omit it here. You will run into one problem. There is a tendency nowadays not to use Roman letters because too many modern readers can't read Roman numbers. If you put down 10 here, it can easily be confused with a half a dozen things, whether that means volume 10 or whether that's page or any number of things. The number of the issue, for instance, Luther witness, the tenth number of that volume. This is going to get you in trouble if you want to modernize your stuff and use a 10. I would always suggest, especially if it's separated, that you better put volume 10 down. This, everybody should know, that a Roman letter always refers to the volume. You don't have quite this problem if you would put it down like this. At the end of the quote. It's more likely to be the case in a footnote than at this point. Well, that's explained to you again on page 6. You add P or double P even though the volume reference is included, since the page or column reference is removed from the volume, removed in distance. Yes, sir?
I have a question. You said if you include the double P below the volume, should be included?
The word does not have to be included. In other words, if you let me start all over, okay, because I got so many other things in here now. Suppose in the course of the description, like you have, well, you have an example right here. I think. Yeah, at the bottom of page 5, a little dim on mine. You notice you can have the word volume there, and you can omit it. Well, you have that swirl cage rule. You can omit it in both places, or you can add it in both places, or you can have one or the other. I would prefer to add that as I have it here, because that's very clear. And I think I like to go from the economy angle. The first one, if you see LXIII there, you know that's volume. And why put it down then? And then if the pages, simply because the eye may not go back again, then you're helping, then you know that's pages. But you wouldn't have to have it. You're correct. It could be omitted. But I said before, I preferred, and I suppose it's sort of a slip that I was making mandatory what I preferred. Yes, sir?
Is there any difference with making difference
whether
you use two small
p's
or two large
p's? Well, yes. because if it's a period in front of it, see, in a footnote, you may have a comma, and then you have to have small p. If you have a period in front of it, the end is the capital letter. So that's all that stands for. That's the difference. Okay?
Anything else on the next page? Encyclopedia articles. Actually, it's the same rule from here on out. I know we get a little unhappy about some of these rules. Because they do discipline us in our own thinking, but actually, much of it is needed for accuracy's sake. You know what you're talking about, but if you begin to have other rules, then the next man doesn't know just what you mean. And we're going to get that if we get to the point of this today, especially in the area of ellipse, one of the most, I think it's a nuisance thing. But you've got to be very precise just where you put the periods, because each one of them means something else. And I see more rules violated there, and as a result, you can also confuse the reader of what was originally said. Well, unwittingly, of course, because you always feel you know what you meant. Periodicals, it's the same thing as books, except you put in the date of publication. In case of a monthly or a quarterly, it's the month and the year, and not needed to, you don't need to separate it with a comma. October, bottom of page six, October 1949. It's proper, the old rule said comma. We'll try to simplify it again to drop the comma.
What is the rule if you have a magazine that, such as Time, which would have not only the volume, but also a number, and then the pagination is separate for each number?
You ignore it because you put the date in. Yeah. See, I mean, actually, they overlap. The number is more valuable to the thesis writer than, I mean, the date is more important than the number. That's all over again. Yeah, that's all right, because if you have this, then what you do, of course, now in the individual footnote, there's no problem because you simply put it, but suppose it were covering two. And then pagination might be, well, let's take a case where they start all over again. Theoretically, this for June, that for July.
I have a question. I think the best example of this is the CPM, which, though published by month, is bound without distinguishing between which month it's bound. So if you look it up on page 586, it won't say August 1966, page 586. The problem here was published by month.
Well, but if we bound,
is there a problem there?
No.
It just put the month out there.
No, we have to put the month in. It's in there.
But you can't find out, perhaps, which month it is.
Oh, sure,
it's published quarterly or monthly.
No, you can find the first page of each section.
And you don't have to do that again.
No, there you have a free house. There you have a real problem. Maybe you're right. That's correct. There you have to use the number then.
What's it?
Well, there is not the page number. There is a number, if there are two in 1 year, there is some distinction. Someone just asked me this recently, and I forgot what it was offhand. Say it's the first one of, there are three for that year. Next year, there's only two.
Okay.
See, look at the first one, the second one. So what they do then, if it's a volume.
All right, now we're getting to my problem. Now, I come along and I say, I'm going to look up this reference. But I don't have that information there, that one. But I know that it's published by the month, if I quote it. So I look it up on page 586, and the article is there, but I can't find out which part that is. The 1, 2, 3, 8, 12, or what is it? Because they cut off the front page of a lot of these things when they find them. They take off everything that doesn't
matter. Oh, they don't.
Or if it's in the cover, see, if it puts it on the cover, then.
Yeah, but look at the first page of CPM. It'll have the.
They'll have
a month on that first page.
Now, there are some journals that don't. They have everything on the front cover. Let me get a better example and bring it up to you.
I wish you would, yeah. Well, now that may be poor binding because, you see, poor binding, the binder, the librarian should have given instructions not to remove cover because it's really part of the essential part of the data.
Because what I'm coming up against, I have volume 10 and then parentheses.
Thank you now.
Five.
Well, you're in trouble because someone gave poor instructions to the bindery. And this, I think CHI, no, the quarterly is going to say, has that too, but it doesn't. It still repeats the, on the first page, what volume the page is. I can see your problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Please.
Well, no, you wouldn't, because this doesn't happen to be an easy one, because you see you'd have 10, July 1940, and then the comma, and then 64. That prior to that tells you its volume.
Would this be okay?
That's perfectly okay, yeah.
See, when you have this cluster, you have no problem, because it always comes up that way. The problem lies when you separate an early part of the 10, and later on it gets to be a... Or you have a problem in some of the German writings, where you have volume 10, part 1, comma, 64. Now that's what that means. And if this is clear, forget about it. But this fellow, this is a different book. I give you a notorious example on it, is Roy's book on the, I forgot the title of it, it's on catechisms and Bible histories, the sources for the 16th century. He has, I suppose in planning, I'm reading through the line between, there are many German books of this nature. They sort of grow like topsies. When they started out, volume one was to be on the catechism, volume two was on Bible history books. Well, he couldn't get it in one volume, so he had part one. Then comes part two, and you couldn't get it all in two, so you got part 2A. See, and then part three. And I think part three goes down to A, B, and C. And there is no second volume to two. So volume one is about 9 or 10 volumes. Volume two is only one volume. And now when you get down to this fellow here, you see, you really have a problem, because even using Roman numbers, and then of course the pages. Now what you can do, of course, is put the word part in if you want to, this sounds, you know, wonder what, so put the final part in front of one of them at least. You'll have quite a few of these if you're dealing with encyclopedias, which were poorly planned. I say poorly, and that's not a fair word. It's they found more material than they really ever thought they'd find. Or there might have been a shift of planning. At first we're only going to cover a certain period. You can get it in one volume. I suppose this Roy's one is about the most notorious example I can think of. But to think of one that's originally a two-volume deal coming out in about 9 or 10 volumes. And it's these A's and 2A's and so on that get to be really troublesome. Well, newspapers are basically the same, except here you have to indicate oftentimes page and column. But this gets to be treacherous, used to be more than it is right now, when, I guess the Globe Democrat comes out in two editions, the so-called state edition and the home edition. And they're not identical. The state edition often carries the news from the previous late edition. Or sometimes it carries news and it's killed in the other edition. We had a notorious example here a couple of years ago when the Pope prior to John the 23rd died. The Globe Democrat on a Sunday edition, which comes out on Saturday, had something which is very embarrassing to the Roman Catholic Church of what was supposed to have been said on his dying bed. It was quoted. And Dr. Charlemagne happened to be in Illinois and read it in his dad's home where they got the edition as the regular Sunday edition, and then he referred to it Monday or Tuesday in a sermon, and we all wanted to get our edition because this is good stuff to keep, and nobody could find it in his edition, because we here in St. Louis all got the second edition. And a lot of people in the city, of course, call in, wait a minute, you've manufactured something, this didn't appear in the Globe Democrat. Well, he was a little embarrassed too, because he knew he had read it, he wasn't seeing things. And he couldn't find it in his own home edition, which he hadn't read, because he had read it over in his dad's parish over the weekend. And so he had to go back and get the old copy, which was in the state edition. Well, somebody evidently saw this and killed it between the first and the second edition. So now you can see what happened, or which one is being saved in the library.
Formerly, I know when I was a youngster, they, in the New York papers, they had a new edition almost every hour. The late afternoon edition, the night edition, the express edition, the home edition, and the state edition. This is normal. Well, that's why quoting from newspapers is very precarious, since you don't always find it in the same one. Therefore, it might be well to indicate which edition you choose, have made the choice. Naturally, when you go back before 1910, 1905, where only one edition was put out, you have no problems. Then reports, and these are really nuisance. They're hard to work out. Sometimes you have to compose your own. Then try to keep your general regulations, the synodical reports. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, that's the author, then the proceedings of the 71st Convention, and most of them, I guess practically all, I'll say CPH publications, so you add that in brackets. Now, the same thing is true in C with the ULCA. Number nine is unpublished material. All theses, for instance, or whatever material is unpublished, you do not underline it. It's never italicized. You simply put it in brackets, in quotes. The same thing is true with letters, diaries, and the like. And you may have to compose your own, like the second one on page 8, Walter's letter to his brother. Well, you put that down. You make the title for it. Obviously, he didn't put any title on his letter. So, letter to his brother, O.H. Walter, dated March 4, 1840, C.H.I., that's where you picked it up. You don't want to lose time at this early stage. Now, taking notes as such, before you start taking notes from a book, particularly of a book, not so important, of a magazine article, be sure you know something about the writer and the writer's bias and point of view, because this will help you understand what is to be said. The part of the book that is usually ignored, you know, we usually start with chapter 1 and begin reading and skip the preface. From a scholar's point of view, the preface or the introduction is most important. It gives you the direction, the stance of the writer, what he had in mind. And thus you learn to understand what he's saying from that viewpoint. You evaluate it. So be sure to do that. May I say, too, don't overdo this business of note-taking. Avoid the repetitious, the things, obviously. But it's also true of the small things, the unimportant ones. On the other hand, don't ever trust your memory. It should be one of the first laws of research. If there's any doubt about whether the note, the idea is valuable, put it down. Now, what makes a good note? How do you evaluate your own notes? There's nothing that's so frustrating that after 6 months, when the stuff is a little cold, you go back, start working on your thesis again, and you look at your old notes, and they really are cold. You don't know what you meant. You abbreviated it so badly. You didn't get the context. You forgot the context in which the fellow said it. Well, it's no good. You have to go back again. Well, then you may even get to the point, well, what good is all my note-taking? Well, the point, the error was in the first place that you did not give the context. Now, that's going to seem so obvious to you at the time when you read it that you don't want to put it down. So the first rule is that a statement is so clear that you put down a direct quote or your summary of it, that it cannot be misunderstood or questioned later on when you're called. Try to give it in its frame of reference. Another good type of note is an illustration, so given that it can be substantially reproduced. And again, to be sure you know what he's illustrating. Otherwise, you may be applying his illustration, and some of these can be just a matter of a shade. He is addressing himself to a specific situation, and you forget the situation, and only fits in that situation. So be sure that's in there. Obviously, a good note would be one where you are collecting the data, which can be used as evidence, or the writer's point of view, so that whenever you quote this fellow, you remember he is trying to prove something. And that'll come in important whenever you quote this fellow. Or your own reaction to this fellow as you read it. This doesn't have to be on a separate card, on the card to a note. Although at times you may want to react immediately to this note. Then put it in brackets so that you don't later on confuse your brilliant idea with his idea. So anything you are adding which is not in the original part, be sure to always put that in brackets. You don't use parentheses, because parentheses have, as you know, an entirely different function. Brackets always mean something has been added by the writer. And that's your own tip-off. And these are very important, these reactions. Oftentimes, these get to be the buds on which you put a chapter or a point that you want to bring home. Now, actually, these reactions or summary ideas may not be related to a specific note. Then I put it, make a separate card on it. And any of these things that, you know, when you can't sleep sometimes at nighttime and you get an idea, for goodness sake, have a notepad nearby, because next morning I'm sure you'll forget it. You've had this experience very often. And I know some people who have this periodically, not only when they're doing thesis work, but have a notepad handy and write it down. Now, I have never done this, but many of my colleagues do it. I have done it at times when I'm hearing a lecture, or even in a sermon. Something the pastor says triggers me off on something some insight that I hadn't gotten before. And I can use it. I'm just working on that problem. Sunday Bulletin's a very, very important hand, something have hand by, nearby to put on your these flashes, these insights, if you don't have paper otherwise. I think that's one reason why they always hand out Sunday Bulletins anyway. Try to summarize rather than quote directly. There is a tendency to overdue and think of, well, later on I can summarize this business. No, I would suggest that if you feel that you don't need this fellow's exact words, and sometimes you do, of course, and very often, I should say, begin to summarize as soon as possible, because there is part of the systematizations. You're pulling the things together. And it's well to do this as soon as possible. Yes, sir?
On recording, I have a question.
No, this is only when you are duplicating it and for profit.
Okay.
Actually, this is even if I would want to do it. Now, there's a little twilight zone, and this is one of the greatest problems right now because of all our process for duplication. Copyright laws are all being rewritten, so to speak. They don't fit. But you're always saving a thesis. Let's put it that way. That's to answer your question. Now, the question of getting a Xerox copy of a copyrighted material. This is, generally speaking, permitted for yourself, for your own note-taking, because they don't care finally whether you copy it with a pencil or whether you do a Xerox. The moment you sell that or give mass distribution, you might be in trouble. Mass distribution is still a gray area, free, because I figure not too many people are going to, they're going to soon get tired of giving things away free. But the moment you sell it, you're in trouble. Even such a little, and of course you know most of the time you can get this permission, they're very happy to give it to you, but they want to be the one to, even this little thing in here, we had to get permission, we didn't want to take, because this was being sold, we took from the interpreter's Bible on page 24, the transliteration. And so that, but you get it, and there's no trouble, it's just a matter of waiting to get an answer. Now, a word on the direct quotes, which is quite difficult. We may not be able to get much beyond that. Let me, and this is a nuisance. I know you're going to probably be impatient with it, but if for the sake of clarity and be sure you're transmitting the exact idea, look at page 15
if you will. There are two hazards, you know, in direct quotation. The one is that you quote out of context. Well, nobody can help you. You've got to do that to avoid that hazard. Quoting out of context is very easily done. The moment you're quoting a man's argument, he's thinking of a given situation, and if your situation in which you are addressing yourself is not identical, it really doesn't fit to that extent anymore. This is one of the greatest problems you have today, you know, when you're trying to quote Pieper or Walther, for good or for ill. Do you have the same case in mind? And you may be doing the man a great injustice simply because the target is gone. He's talking about something else. But I said, no one can prevent you from doing that except yourself. The other great hazard is, of course, that you don't quote accurately. This could be purely something that's careless. You misspell words or you leave out words, and all of us know that that is a tremendous hazard. But part of the failure to quote correctly may be due to your attempt to abbreviate. And the most common type of abbreviation is the ellipsis, where you don't want to quote the whole paragraph or the whole page or the whole sentence. And you want to indicate that you are omitting something. Now, the most common, of course, quotation would be one where you'd start something in the middle of a sentence, and you're simply taking it out of that section and you put it in quotes. You know, people know that it's a quotation because you say so. They know it's part of a sentence because you start with a lowercase letter. That's what tells you that this is not the beginning of a sentence. You have no period on the end, and so you know that this is a phrase or a clause taken from within. That's simple. There's no problem there. Yes, sir?
You don't have a problem.
In this case.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
I should try to figure another way,
I think your normal structure will help you that
for instance, I give you Gunnar Mies said that Luther, you know, and I start with Luther, it's a bad example.
Oh.
All
right, well now, see, in that case, it isn't important, in this particular case, knowing whether it is part of the beginning of another sentence, because it makes sense. You're not changing the meaning. It only becomes dangerous, the lower and the larger opening of the part of the sentence, when there is a danger of changing the meaning. Now, you might still be able to give me one where this could be done. Then you'll probably have to jump to one of the other rules that I want to give you in a minute. And that would be, and you'll have to make that decision, and I suppose, finally, that's what you would do. When the omission is prior to, and you're talking about the sentence, then you would, the ellipsis, which is three dots with a space between it, indicates there is something omitted ahead of time, and you are now quoting it. Or, this is the end of the quote, whatever it is, and this is goes now to the end of the sentence, and you put the fourth one in there. That fourth one indicates that there is something missing before you get to the end of the sentence. The extra period is the period of the sentence. Now, if it's this way, and now the next sentence begins with even so and so and so. Part of the quote yet. You notice it's right next to it. That means that this is the end of the sentence. You are skipping a whole sentence. Or two sentences, or three sentences. And now you keep on going. This is what I meant before. And these are the examples that are on the bottom of page 15.